Well, tonight you're going to get two facets of an incredible story. First of all, in part one, Paula Harris joins us throughout the evening as we talk about her work, Exopolitics, Gateway to a New Reality. And then later on in the program, several witnesses are coming in to talk about a 1945 UFO crash near San Antonio, New Mexico, not Texas, New Mexico. And it's an incredible story. And we'll be back with Paula in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Paula Harris is an Italian-American photojournalist, investigative reporter in the field of extraterrestrial-related phenomena research. Now, she has studied extraterrestrial-related phenomena since 1979. She assisted Dr. J. Allen Hynek with his UFO investigations. She teaches history and photojournalism and online classes in exopolitics for Dr. Michael Sala's Exopolitics Institute, for which she is an international liaison director. She is very sought after at special UFO conferences around the world. And here she is back on Coast to Coast. Paula, how are you?
Fine. How are you, George?
Wonderful. Now, where are you? Sometimes you're in Italy. Sometimes you're here in the States. Where are you now?
Well, I'm in Boulder, Colorado right now. I'm in the States right now.
All right. Here you are. How was your Thanksgiving, by the way?
Oh, it was wonderful. I mean, we had a great time, and Boulder is a beautiful place.
You getting ready for Christmas now?
Yeah, I am. If I would just slow down a little bit, it seems like I'm always on the computer. I mean, I think we live a computer life.
You don't know how to slow down, Paula. You have not slowed down since I've known you.
No, it's not my fault. I think it's really strange you mention this, because sometimes I think that what I do is guided, that I don't have a choice. It's like I end up at the right place at the right time.
It sure does. Now, tell me, you first of all, we've got a lot going on tonight. You're bringing in a few witnesses next hour. We'll take calls in the last hour on an incredible story. But tell me about your new work, Exopolitics, Stargate to a New Reality.
Well, this is going to be my last Exopolitics book. And the reason why I wrote this one is it's a gift to the young people of the world. I've come to the conclusion, and you know, you've seen me at different conferences, that all I do is preach to the choir. I mean, I'm there speaking to people that already believe, that already know, that have a background, and I'm getting very frustrated. So I came to the conclusion that this book is going to be dedicated to the young people of the future. It has some 15 interviews in it, including three pilot interviews. It has preface is written by Travis Walton. He's a very good friend of mine. It's a very, very deep preface by Travis, who talks about disclosure. And the foreword is written by Brent Smith, who is a 25-year-old student here at Naropa Institute, the son of Yvonne Smith, the abduction researcher. And I've dedicated this book to the young people because my vision is, George, that everything I did, all the witness testimony, the word-for-word interviews, will go in a library someday, and these guys have to have it. They have to have the people's words. They have to have the original source. That's the only way we can piece together this UFO phenomenon. So that's what the book's about.
Paula, what drives you? You have not stopped. You keep going. How come?
Well, I'm curious, aren't you? I'm really curious. What's going on? What's been going on? How long has it been going on? What has been hidden from us? Why can we talk about it tonight? I mean, the story I've got for you tonight, we could never have covered 10 years ago, ever. So somebody is guiding this slow process release of information, George, where we can talk about things today we could never talk about in the past, because I think somebody, and I have no idea who it is, wants us to know the truth. And the truth, in the end, is that we are not alone.
You know, you may be right. They may not come out forthright to tell us, but we may find out on our own. You know, I've got this on-running disagreement with my buddy Steve from Washington, D.C., because, you know, Steve is, you know, he feels as if disclosure is coming imminently. David Wilcock feels disclosure's coming. I don't, Paula. I don't think governments will turn loose and let us know what's going on.
No, they can't. They can't. It's not logical. They can't do it, because if they do that, you can picture a tapestry unraveling with lies that start, you know, that never end. Now, even the case, I mean, the San Antonio case that you're going to talk about tonight, it came before Roswell. Can you imagine the Air Force trying to explain that when they're still talking about crash test dummies and about mogul balloons? You know, when they do not admit that there has been something going on, and then somebody out of the clear blue sky it comes out and says something has been going on, then we got problems here because it's a lack of trust. Now, there's supposed to be a big announcement by NASA tomorrow. Now, how are they going to do that? I'm really curious what's going to happen with that, because you cannot just tell the people in 24 hours something that we've known for a long time and not explain why you kept it secret.
Well, that's a good point, indeed. Tell me about these credible witnesses that are cropping up all over the place these days.
Well, it's age. I can only tell you, I had a long conversation with Don Schmidt, whom you know. He's an excellent Roswell researcher. Actually, Don's interview's in my book, too, because he calls it the race with the Undertaker. It's age. When people reach a certain age and they have lived a certain experience, and in the case of Remy Baca and Jose Padilla, they have permission of their families. Now, they're in their 70s. They have permission to talk about it. They want to talk about it because they have to leave this behind as a legacy to the young people, or to the young people, to future generations, to a time when we will have disclosure. And they need to leave. They lived it. It's not something they made up, and it certainly isn't something that, you know, they read about on internet. It's something they lived, and they need to leave it behind. And so the age, you know, a lot of the interviews, even in my book, the men are in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. And by the way, I'm going to take an opportunity right now to say that one of the interviews is Milton Torres, who was the pilot mm-hmm. that, you know, was asked to shoot down a UFO in 1957. And Milton Torres is very gravely ill. And, you know, I'm very sad about that. His son called me. And, you know, I'm so sad because this is a man that gave me his testimony and made me swear as a journalist that I would tell the world. And I know how they feel. So these are people that we need to take seriously, George.
Well, it was because of you we got Milton on the air about a year and a half ago. And his son's been on, too. And I remember meeting him at one of Stephen Bassett's ex-conferences. I also remember how emotional you were when they talked about John Mack. You still haven't gotten over that.
Oh, well, that was traumatic for me. I mean, this is a man. He was supposed to come to my conference in Italy, and I got a call that he had died. But it was a man, George, and for the people out there that love John Mack the way I did, and everybody did. He was a man who was rational, intelligent, a college professor, and a man that had put it together, a man that knew how to talk to witnesses, that did not make value judgments. You know, all too often, before we even get a chance to let the person tell a story, we've already told them they're crazy and that you don't believe it and so forth and so on. But John had an incredible bedside manner where he was a great listener. He would let the person tell the story. And John did much for ufology. You know, George, you know this because he made it legit.
Yeah, and he sure did. I mean, this was a Harvard psychiatrist who decided to put his neck in the noose and started to investigate, as Bud Hopkins has and all of you have, UFO abductees and cases like that. Truly remarkable guy.
Well, yeah, and I have this theory, George, that it doesn't matter who has the ball. We're all on the football team, and we should be running behind the quarterback. Yeah. It can be anybody that really gets this down the line. And I want to herald Stephen Bassett for that, too, because, that you know, he has done so much. I would never have met some of these witnesses if it hadn't been for the X conference. All right, even though I don't agree about disclosure coming from Obama or the president and so forth, he's done so much. And whoever has the ball presently is who we should be behind. we shouldn't be fighting each other, and we shouldn't be, you know, debunking each other, and we shouldn't be criticizing each other. I'm a real believer in working together as a team.
Do we know what got John Mack interested in covering abductees? I mean, this guy, surely, when he got his degree in medicine, when he became a psychiatrist, when he was at Harvard, he didn't wake up one morning and say, I'm going to cover these UFO cases. What happened? Do we know?
Well, one of the things that happened was he was getting the stories. He was getting the stories from credible people. Two of the people were some of his colleagues. I mean, in the last, you know, he came to Florence, Italy, and I had to interpret for him because it was a very young people's conference. And John loved young people. They were college kids. And they had a conference. John talked about how, in the beginning, he got these stories from very credible people, and he had to digest the fact that something is going on. And he decided to take the responsibility, that which a lot of people don't do. He said, okay, something is going on. I will take the responsibility, risk my career, and see what's going on here. Because he realized that it was all interconnected. This is about consciousness also. It's not just about abduction. And I'll tell you, you might be interested, just before he died, we were in my living room in Rome, and he said, you know, Paula, he said, I think that the actual physical abduction syndrome, where they actually are physically taken, has diminished. Now people are getting direct downloads, which means people are being contacted without being taken. So a lot of people are getting ideas or visions or whatever about the future. I heard you talking about that. Without actually being taken.
By the way, I met a woman from Italy. She kept saying, Bella, Bella, what does that mean? What was she saying?
Beautiful. I mean, Bella is beautiful.
You're not pulling my leg, are you?
No, is that what she said to you?
Yeah, it's not a bad word, is it?
No, she said you were handsome, or she said you were
you never know.
Bella.
You never know, you know, with these languages.
Well, they're very romantic people, the Italians.
She had a glass of wine in her hand. What can I say, right?
Yeah, right. It's perfect.
You're a believer in Roswell, right?
Oh, it's not even to have to believe. I've talked to the people that are down there. I've talked to Glenn Dennis, and I've talked, when he was alive, to Walter Hott and so forth. No, they're not lying. The problem is these people are not lying, and we don't know what to do to get these stories out.
No, we don't. We've got the people like Stanton Friedman and so many other researchers, Kevin Randall and all of them,
who've
investigated this. And they've all done a great job. You know, it's a tough business. First of all, I've got to compliment you, Paula, and all of you, Richard Dolan, all of you who just continue to work. I mean, you do research and you do write your books, but I mean, you have given up so much to get this out, to get the story out. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. I couldn't do it. I couldn't devote.
But
the
you are doing it. I mean,
yeah, but I get paid for this. I mean, you guys are doing this on your own dollar, and not a lot of people do that. And I have to applaud you for that.
Thank you very much. This story cost me money because I flew to the place, and also I've my phone bills and so forth. And every story I've done has cost me out of my pocket quite a few thousand dollars. In fact, my family's saying, "Why are you doing it? You could work for UNICEF."
Well, I want a million people to buy your book, Exopolitics.
And
then you can buy your own plane.
But they can put it in their library, because what's in there is the 15 interviews from the pilots and from the, you know, credible people. I you know, so many people have given me great interviews. And they're the firsthand sources. They're the people that lived it, and that's what my true belief is. It's a historical thing, George, what you're doing. You know, people that download your show and people that read the interviews in my books, that's history. That's going to go in some department of some university in the future, when people have to do, future kids 100 years from now, have to do a research paper on something they know is real. And so they have to go to the original source. That's how you do research. I'm basically a teacher, so I know that you have to do firsthand research. So, you know, it's historical. So many people download your shows because you got the real people on there.
There's a local restaurant in the St. Louis area. I go there a lot before the show, and then I, you know, come back and get ready and get ready to go. And there's this is a great story. You're going to love this, Paulie. Guy from Italy. I meet him there about 8 months ago. He gets hired as a waiter. His name's Adele. He listens, by the way, every night to Coast to Coast now. He gets off work. He's obsessed with it. He's locked into it. And he says, are you talking about UFOs tonight? UFOs tonight.
Yeah,
I told him about you, and I said, you're Italian. And he couldn't wait. But on the first day that he got hired at this restaurant, he got hired. He was all excited. He goes out, and he goes, where's my car? They towed his car away. Not the restaurant, but the city did.
Yeah.
He had it parked in a no parking area. He didn't know that. And they took it away. So on his first day, it cost him $144 to get his car out of hock. And so, but to make a long story short, he's obsessed with ufology. He says in Italy, it's one of the biggest stories ever. And I didn't know that, is it?
Yeah, well, I started working in Italy. I started in 1997 working for my boss, Maurizio Baiata, excellent researcher, one of the five top in the world. And we did five different magazines, that's how I started. I mean, because they knew I had worked with Hynek. So it was so much easier for me because nobody laughed there, George. I mean, everybody's curious. And when we had conferences, we had people come in that were astrobiologists that were astronomers that were scientists, because I think they had a personal curiosity, and it's much more open in Europe. Here, you know, if I even mention, I'm almost embarrassed. People say to me, what do you do? And I say, I'm a writer. And when they ask me what I write, it's like, part of me is embarrassed. And this is ridiculous, but it's how they make you feel, because as Stephen Bassett says, we are still in the ghetto. We are still on the fringe. They do not take this seriously, and this is so serious. It's also a matter of national security. And a lot of the people that I interviewed were military. They're, you know, I just did an incredible interview with Robert Salas. You know who that is.
Yes, sure.
You know, Maelstrom Air Force Base shutdown. It's on my website. Yeah, I mean, you want to tell me what's funny about that?
Where would we be today if John Mack were still alive, if J. Allen Hynek were still alive? Where would we be?
Well, it's a walking both worlds, because, you know, Allen was also hired by the Blue Book people. I think there is a contingent there.
But he changed. He changed.
He
right?
changed, but he also was accountable. I mean, I don't think you can ever get out of that. I'm wondering, you know, it's really hard, because for us researchers, we're doing the work, but there is a group in the back room that is following our work.
Hynek will always be known as the swamp gas guy, no matter what.
Yeah, George, he was very embarrassed about that. He was very embarrassed. It was a last-minute explanation that he had, but, you know, the thing is that he had to come up with something. And, you know, the irony is in my interview with Robert Salas, here I am in Boulder, Colorado, where the Condon Committee report.
That's right.
The official Condon Committee report of 1968-69 said that there was nothing to worry about, that this wasn't real. And here they had just gotten the information about the missile shutdowns. You want to tell me why they didn't look at it as a matter of national security?
And it should have been. Paula, when we come back, I want you to set the stage of the San Antonio, New Mexico crash. We'll be right back. Okay, now tomorrow, NASA is supposed to make some kind of announcement about some kind of extraterrestrial life. We have no idea what it is. We've got Bob Zimmerman standing by, Linda Moulton Howe, Richard C. Hoagland. We'll have that story for you for the first couple hours. Then later on in the program, Tom Horn joins us with his work on the Nephilim stargates, another fascinating facet of the program. We'll have all that for you, breaking news and everything else on Coast to Coast AM. When I come back, we're going to talk with Paula Harris about the 1945 San Antonio, New Mexico crash. Just what was it? And then next hour, a few witnesses will join us. And then in our last hour with Paula, we'll take your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with Paula Harris. Paula, tell us about this San Antonio crash in New Mexico, 1945. What happened?
Well, first of all, it happened in August of 1945, where two little boys that lived in San Antonio. Jose Padilla was 9, and Remy Baca was 7 at the time. And Jose's father had told them to go out to look for a cow that has calved. And what happened is, while they were doing what they were doing on their horses, there was a major thunderstorm. And, you know, this is very important. The details of this story is important because the weather in New Mexico, especially when there's thunder and lightning, has a lot to do with interference with these craft.
Okay.
Well, during this time period, this craft, they watched a craft to come in, a crash, and I think it's and Remy will tell you, leave a half-mile trench, stop, and the two boys went up to the craft about 200 yards away and saw that a piece of it was broken off. They saw the beings, which Remy will describe to you, were he said they were like, weren't walking, they were kind of sliding back and forth, and as two small children are watching this in the dust, and in this major storm, they're watching this situation, and it changed their entire life, because naturally they went back, and Jose told his father, and his father called the sheriff, and within the next 3 days of the recovery, these two little boys were watching the military clean this up. Now, why this is important, because they were curious, so they on the Arroyo, they would look at the military clean this up. Why it's important is because the older boy, and he will tell you himself, and this is what's so important, he will tell you, while the craft was on the flatbed truck, actually went inside the craft and pulled off a piece. And this is the first time I've ever seen or heard of a story that where we have a piece of the inside of a craft. We've had pieces of the outside of craft, but this is a piece of the inside. It's on your website, George, because I put pictures there. And it's so important that you speak to the witnesses themselves. But it's been a year that I've been questioning them. It's been a year that I've followed up on the details. And it occurs to me that whoever was visiting that area, and this is the White Sands area, 10 miles from Ground Zero there, whoever is visiting that area was interested in our atomic bomb testing. And then I come to find out, because I released this story, I'm getting other witnesses coming forth that have said that not only were they part of the military, but they know of this story. So see, this is the importance of bringing out a story like this, because other people that would not talk are now coming out and talking about this. I originally got this story from a man whose father was the pilot that said he flew out the bodies of the 1945 San Antonio crash. That's how I originally got the story. And then they gave me Remy Baca's, telephone number, and I talked to him for a solid year. I started this in May of 2009. So this is very important for people to understand. Roswell was not the only crash. That whole area was an area of interest to someone.
Absolutely. Now, why is it coming out now? I mean, this is 2 years before Roswell, Paula.
Yeah, why is it coming out? Because, first of all, these witnesses had reached out to other researchers who kind of blew it off.
Okay. And they've got to be what? They've got to be in their 70s. How old?
They're in their 70s. Okay. They're in their 70s, but they tried to talk to other people about this. And, you know, you have to really listen. You have to really piece this together. Remy will tell you, he'll tell you his family was not totally supportive. His wife did not believe in UFOs. She was Catholic. She's Catholic. Jenny is a wonderful lady. And they had a sighting. And after she had the sighting, she said it was okay for her husband to talk. Now, I have a chapter in my new book called The Burden of Truth. The burden that these witnesses carry, that they can't talk because either their families don't want them to, or they, you know, it's so bizarre that they know their life is going to change. I don't think people like making this up. This is not a made-up story. This is real because it will change their lives. And they feel a certain burden to tell the truth, and especially at this age.
Well, that's great. And I can't wait to talk to both of them next hour, because they even have descriptions of what the craft looks like, don't they?
Oh, yeah, because they walked up to it. Well, they're two little boys. I mean, they basically thought it was a plane crash. They probably thought it was a major accident. They walked right up to it. And it's very interesting. I hope you ask Remy about the feelings he had when he saw the beings. They heard a high, high screeching.
Well, if I don't, you will. You're going to be on with me.
Okay. They heard a high screeching that they thought the beings were hurt, because they heard this very loud pitch sound. And Jose wanted to run in and help them, but Remy started to cry. He was so scared. But what was interesting, and I hope they tell you about this, since it was one of the first crashes, the cleanup crew didn't know how to handle it. They did not have hazmat suits on. They weren't worried about radiation. They'll tell you that some of the military men threw pieces in a trench.
Who was the cleanup crew? Military then, right?
Yep, military men that were stationed right there at the base, there at the White Sands facility right there. And there, I had heard about a bar called the Owl Bar Cafe. I'd heard about this because I'd heard that Oppenheimer went there often, and the paperclip scientist. It was the only watering hole around.
Sure.
And the fact that the part of the cleanup crew would go into this watering hole where there was like a soda fountain and there was a bar and you could get food and everything. They would go in there and leave the craft on the flatbed truck. They would leave it there. And that's when Jose jumped on the truck and went in. I mean, they didn't have any protocols. I mean, after Roswell, probably between 45 and 47, there were other crashes, but protocols were put into place then where they were probably much more secure than they were in the 45 crash, because the 45 crash was a little bit haphazard. And this is what I've talked about with Remy for the longest time, because they were watching the guys, in the cleanup crew. In fact, it was one of the military people that approached Jose's father and asked if they could replace the gate, because they were going to take out a balloon, a weather balloon. And again, we got a weather balloon story here. And it was too big to go through the gate, so they would have to replace the gate.
That's an amazing story.
Isn't that amazing? Because yeah. The thing is, the father said, of course, but he said, I don't understand why you have to take my gate apart.
How did you come across this story?
Well, again, it was someone who wrote to me about his father, another person who wrote to me about his father flying the bodies of the 1945 crash. And I said, what crash in 1945? I didn't know anything about this. And then he proceeded to give me Remy Bach's telephone number. And, of course, in the beginning, I was just gabbing with Remy. And then I think finally he trusted me that I would represent them, adequately with their own words. That's why I'm so adamant about having the witnesses tell their story. I mean, I always tell the UFO world, this is not about us. We are just the tools. We are just the journalists. We are just the radio people who are bringing out the story, but it is not about us. It is about the people that lived the case. It is about the witnesses. So I think tonight is historic, George.
I think so too.
Yeah, this is the first time in America that this comes out, because I've already released it in Italy.
And how did the Italians react to this?
Oh, well, the Italians got part one of my 33-page interview, and they're very interested. They've contacted the magazine and so forth about they want to hear the whole entire story. And they're very interested in it, because they're waiting for us. It unfortunately or fortunately, it's happening here. In the New Mexico area and in this area, they're waiting for us to piece together the pieces of the puzzle.
What took them so long? I mean, because you discovered them, why are they going public now?
Well, because I think that in the case of Remy, I think he and his wife talked about that it's okay. Because, you know, in the beginning, you know, in families, they don't always agree because it changes the family structure. In the Burden of Truth, in my book, I talk about how serious it is when a family member comes forth. Oh, look what happened to Jesse Marcel Jr.'s family. Sure. You know, look at what happened to other people's families. You want to keep your family intact. You do not want to have, you know, a lot of unwanted publicity. So they're very courageous, both of these witnesses, to come forth and tell their story the way it was. You know, they're of a certain age. In a way, you've got nothing to lose.
Tell me about your thoughts, your personal thoughts, Paul, on this planet being visited, ongoing visitations. Is it happening?
Well, I'm going to get, first of all, I've been having some great conversations with Carol Rosen. Do you know her?
She worked with the Wernher von Braun.
She's an amazing lady, and I hope you get her on the show sometime. Because Wernher von Braun told her a lot. And the thing is that, you know, we've come to the conclusion that what is happening, the visitations, are more warnings than anything else, that whoever is visiting is benign. They are not hostile. Otherwise, I'll tell you, the people that are come to me and say, oh, aliens are cruel, they're demons, and so forth, I tell them to watch television. I don't think aliens cut people up and throw them in trash dumpsters after they abduct them. You know, this is what I'm watching night after night, the violence on planet Earth, the crimes that are being committed, and we're putting our yardstick on an alien. You know, whatever is visiting us, I've come to the conclusion, my personal thoughts, that they are warnings of an immense change in the future. And a window of time, George, a window. We've got a small window of time to make a few decisions, to make a few changes. If we don't make them, my feeling, like Carol's, is they're going to go home. They're going to go away. Just leave us to our, you know, self-destruction. And the thing is that I think that, you know, any group of sightings is just a warning. It's like, we're here. Get a clue. Try to do something, because we are coming on a very, very crucial period in the history of humanity. I don't have to talk about it. Your show talks about it.
And, what do you think?
Thing is, we need to make some decisions.
What do you think this NASA announcement might be tomorrow?
I think if they're going to announce extraterrestrial life, it's going to be microbes in some meteor.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah. They're not going to, unless they say we have spotted cities on Mars. And
I'd love that.
Hoagland's been pretty quiet. Hoagland's been quiet the last couple of days. I wonder if he's there.
He's such a joy. This thing about Mars, I have personal research I've done in Italy through the daughter of Marconi and other people that I've interviewed, you know, scientists and so forth. The idea that Mars is inhabited is logical. It's logical. It was inhabited is logical. And the fact that we could go back there, it's logical. And that maybe we have already gone back there, that's logical too. It's just that the secret is being kept, I think, for the monetary reasons and the economic reasons of promoting the status quo of planet Earth. I mean, that's also logical. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure all this out.
Well, they announced today that there are trillions of Earth-like planets out there. That's what they speculate, because they've found three times as many stars as they ever thought they would. I mean, the incredible technology is allowing them to do that. It's only a matter of time before they come forward and say, okay, if we assume that there are trillions of Earth-like planets and this primordial soup is the same throughout the universe, we then have to assume that if an Earth-like planet is in this habitational level near their sun, near their star, life is going to evolve, and it's probably going to evolve the way we have.
We have, and maybe some of those planets have evolved to a much more, you know, a greater consciousness.
Of course.
We're pretty primitive here.
Well, give them a million years head start on us. I mean, how advanced can you be? I mean, look at our technology over the last 100 years. I mean, give it a million years. If we survive, can you imagine the things that we'll be doing?
Well, yeah, exponentially our technology is growing. But, you know, like Edgar Mitchell said, you know, I had this conversation with him. Is our consciousness and our spiritual consciousness evolving with the technology, our responsibility? You know, we can have cell phones, we can have everything, but are we still humans? Do we still have the values that humans are supposed to have? Do we still have the love, compassion, and togetherness? Or are we greedy? You know, what is humanity like? What's it going to be like? And I think that's where we're coming down to the crossroads. I really believe in the next couple of years, we're going to have a whole different scenario here, George.
I think so, too, and it's going to be pretty dramatic.
Yeah, it is.
But in terms of disclosure, it'll come from whistleblowers, not the government. You agree?
It'll come from two things, whistleblowers and the aliens themselves, probably. You know, I had mentioned, picture the scenario of five craft over five different airports. Right now, the airport in China is the one that's being visited the most because they've had to shut the airport down several times. And so, you know, all we need is a couple of O'Hare situations where the craft is above the airport. And what are you going to tell the people? And there's another thing, George, the fact that there is a commercial venture in New Mexico. Again, look at New Mexico with Sir Richard Branson and Burt Rutan, who are going to send civilians into space. And what if they see something? What are you going to tell them, to be quiet? He was saying the other day that he's got all kinds of people ready, about 500 tickets he's sold to go into space. And this is commercial.
People are buying them. Yeah, people are buying them, and they're buying them for big dollars.
$250,000 a ticket or something like that. That's a story I want to do. I really have been
looking. And $50 for 4 suitcases.
I would love to go and interview those guys because I think they know something we don't.
Are you getting witnesses in an easy fashion, or is it difficult?
They come to me. I don't know what it is. As I told you, I happen to be at the right time at the right place. They usually come to me because I listen, and I listened for a long time. I told you this took a year. I did the Charles Hall case. That took a year and a half. It's like, a lot of people, I have to piece it together. I have to see if it fits. I have to see if the people are telling the truth. I have to see what their motivation is. I have to visit their families. I mean, this is what Alan Hynek taught me.
Well, you've had witnesses then that you've interviewed, and you think they're not telling me the truth. That's happened, right?
Yeah. I've had some situations where I won't touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Okay. Well, that's
because I can tell the difference. It's just 30 years of working. I just can't do it. I can't touch it. But this case is probably the second biggest case I've done in my entire career. The first one was Colonel Philip Corso.
Corso was one of the best.
It was the best.
Well, we've got a couple eyewitnesses coming up in just a moment to this incredible story that you've set the stage for, Paula. And we'll have you do it again briefly when we come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. I mean, they were there. They were 7 years old. They were 9 years old when they witnessed a crashed UFO in San Antonio, New Mexico. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.